live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican consultant Doug O'Brien, Democrat consultant Dan Shulman, and John Kochelko from Cicero, Illinois, and we welcome you all to our broadcast. Our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to send us an email comment, it's btb@museum.tv. The broadcast coming to you from our home base at the new Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago. Nice to have you with us. We've got lots to talk about in the next couple of hours. Obviously, big stories in Libya, big stories in the weather, again, dominating much of the news, and again, a sort of a bombshell in the Republican presidential field, at least if you look at the polls. The Gallup organization now has Rick Perry actually comfortably in the lead insofar as the favorite of a Republican candidate. So we'll get to those graphic involving Rick Perry in just a few moments. But let me tell you that we've had so much hype about the weather. I want to get everybody's reaction. I'm going to spend just a few seconds talking about the weather and the politics of the weather. Too much hype, Dan Shulman?
Bruce, thanks for having me on the program. I think that it wasn't too much hype because of the fact that, you know, we had to prepare in advance and get people out of the evacuation zones. And I think the reason why it was not more serious was because people took the warnings, heeded the warnings, and moved quickly.
Doug O'Brien, your reaction?
Well, first off, it ended up being a less severe storm meteorologically than it could have been. And that's always part of the guesswork of predicting the weather. It ended up coming ashore and spending most of its time as a Category 2 hurricane. But obviously, nobody in this day and age wants to repeat any of the catastrophic a Katrina incident. And so there is particular attention being paid. We do run the risk if we get into the habit of full mobilization every time we have a tropical storm 500 miles off the coast, that the public will become complacent again. But it's just going to be an ebb and flow of the public's reaction to preparedness.
John Kochelko, what do you think?
Well, when a storm of this magnitude is headed for Washington, D.C. and New York City, you're best to err on the side of preparedness. It's fortunate that it turned out not to be as catastrophic as we had feared, but I certainly think that that at all levels of government, we did the right thing by preparing for the worst.
And for those people that are listening around the country who live in Oklahoma or in other areas or the South, obviously, where there's events like this more frequently, I mean, would there be that much hype if it was in another part of the country? It might be in Florida, and certainly it might be in Louisiana now because of Katrina. But again, what about all those folks in Oklahoma and Texas? That's where you're from.
Well, I'm from Texas, correct. But the news cycles and the news operations are centered in Washington and New York. So that's where the hurricane was heading. It covered such a broad area. But I want to point out that the governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, said FEMA did a great job. Was very proud of them. I think that the Obama administration deserves credit for that. The president's been on top of this from the beginning, and I give him tremendous credit.
Do you give him credit, Dan? Doug, rather?
Yes, the administration did what they're getting paid to do. Yahoo. Congratulations. Thanks for showing up to work. We look at everything now in the context of Katrina,
right,
which had numerous failings, but let's not start casting bronze statues because we responded appropriately to a Category 2 hurricane.
And I heard on one of the talk shows this morning that the president and his staff had been making a lot of phone calls and had called the mayors and the governors, and I suppose they could have found out from Al Roker that the storm was coming. I don't know they needed to hear that from Washington, D.C. But apparently they were prepared, and to the extent they were prepared, fine. Well,
for all those people who may be thanking FEMA at the moment, one person who did not thank FEMA was Ron Paul, who was on Fox today, and he excoriated FEMA, saying it was really one of the most incompetently run federal agencies. Actually, and I thought he made a pretty strong case, at least economically, about some of the, you know, the basket case they are.
Well, I want to make another point. Ironically, today the news was about the new book coming out by Dick Cheney, who's blaming Governor Kathleen Blanco for the Katrina scandal. So playing the blame game instead of admitting the faults and the mistakes that the Bush administration made in Katrina. As far as Ron Paul blaming
But
FEMA,
any mistakes they made were in the wake, no pun intended, of mistakes that were made by the mayor of New Orleans and the governor of Louisiana at that point.
Well, I just think it's interesting that years later, Dick Cheney is still blaming he accepts very little responsibility, even though President Bush accepted responsibility for what happened. You've got Dick Cheney still saying, "Well, we didn't do anything wrong."
Well, I suspect that if this had turned out badly, that there would have been staffers for the Obama administration trying to figure out how to blame it on George W. Bush. I mean, everything else that's gone wrong for this administration has been blamed on George W. Bush. Why not Hurricane Irene?
Well, you know, Dan sort of made, I think, a point contrary to what he was trying to make, that President Bush did admit that there were failures during Katrina. But that doesn't diminish Vice President Cheney's comment. The fact is that Kathleen Blanco, under the construct that existed pre-Katrina, did not follow the procedures that were in place to mobilize. And that goes to Ron Paul's the basis
right.
of Ron Paul's comments, which is that disaster preparedness becoming centralized by the more centralized, starting with the Bush administration, but accelerated in the Obama administration, represents more centralization of what, to a lot of people, should be more of a decentralized function.
Well, you know what I was also thinking about? I was also thinking about, you know, probably the most memorable line of Rick Perry's, announcement for president when he said, "I want to make Washington, D.C. inconsequential in your life." And I'm wondering, in times like these, and again, we've not had the disaster like Katrina, but I'm wondering in times like these when the federal government is mobilized, whether it's the Weather Service that's giving warnings, whether it's FEMA that's preparing for things, or God forbid, if there's a horrible situation, the way they do move in. Granted, Paul says they're not efficiently run, but I'm wondering whether there's a lot of people, John, that says, you know what, I don't want the federal government involved when something like this breaks out.
Well, I wouldn't say we don't want them involved, but we have this concept of first responders, and first responders are the local police, fire, emergency services. You move up to the county level.
But that automatically
happens.
This
was why Hurricane Katrina, I thought, was such an unfair rap on George W. Bush, and I maintain to this day it was unfair, because you had an essentially incompetent mayor of New Orleans. You had an inexperienced governor. I think she meant well. But I think the governor's main responsibility at the time was to look out the window waiting for the federal helicopters to arrive. There was no leadership exercised at the local level. And the media simply decided that all the blame rested with the president of the United States, which I thought was horribly unfair.
1-800-723-8029 from the politics of weather, if you want to weigh in on that. We're going to move to some other areas, including, we've been talking about Ron Paul, now third in the latest Gallup poll. We'll talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Canton, Ohio, to Cucamonga, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Dan Shulman is with us. He is our Democrat, card-carrying Democrat. We're going to talk a little bit about your some of the things that you've been involved with. Most interestingly, probably more than any guest who's ever been on this program, probably as close a friend to the President of the United States. He worked for him for many years legislatively, and we'll talk about that as the program unfolds. People have already heard you're carrying the water and the torch for your former friend or current friend and the former state senator from Illinois, as we refer to him in Illinois. But you were going to make a point about Chris Christie of New Jersey.
Well, even the big mouth leader of the Republican Party was saying, "Oh, FEMA's here. We're working with FEMA." He was gay. He was all over FEMA. I mean, FEMA was his best friend. But if you would leave it to Chris Christie, or if you leave it to Ron Paul and some of the Republicans like Rick Perry, you would take away the trailers in Louisiana. One of the things Paul was saying today was they gave out too many trailers and people got trailers that weren't supposed to get them. I'm like, people that got the trailers were in the worst possible condition of humanity. And if you read the stories and the heartbreak and the terrible situations that they had, I think that that is a sin for Mr. Paul to criticize these very disadvantaged people to for what
no,
they
but,
suffered.
No, but what Paul...
That's not
what,
the
what,
argument he was
no,
making
no,
at
the
all.
The argument he was making was that we spend too much money on wars. We should pull money out of the war machine, bring those troops home. So traditionally, they would perform the role of what the National Guard, you know, mm-hmm. has been for many, many years. And that's, you know, working on floods and hurricanes and things of that nature. And again, the huge amount of money that is, he views, wasted on foreign militarism could best be spent in, responding quicker and getting rid of a federal agency that, again, he said a couple of times that he thought it was maybe one of the most mismanaged agencies of all. John?
Well, I don't believe that the regular army and the regular armed forces exist to do civilian-type work in the United States. They are trained to wage war, and they're trained to defend the United States of America. So I don't agree with the notion that we pull all of our forces back
what
to the United
States. What about the National
States.
Guard, though?
That's the National Guard's function. They have the dual responsibility. They are a state force, and they are there to provide backup to the regular police in times of emergency, and they receive training for that. But that's not the function of the profession. We now have a professional army, a regular army, and that's not their job. And the second point I have a problem with
is... Well, I just want to...
Sure.
I would separate the two as well. I'm talking about if you had more National Guardsmen returning from foreign service back home, then perhaps they would be in a better position to do some of these functions. And again, I might argue with you that, you know, if our U.S. military is so great, which they are, in doing nation building and going in and building roads and highways and bridges on foreign soil when it needs to be done, or airlifting huge, mechanized support to a weather-ravaged nation around the world, they should be able to do it in upstate New York or Illinois or wherever else.
Well, I think we've gone too deep into this concept of nation building. I don't think the military exists to build nations. They exist to defend this nation. So I don't necessarily go along with the notion that this is the function of the military, to be building bridges and roads for the Afghans or the Iraqis or anybody
else.
But
that's what they do.
And I'm saying that I'm not sure that that's a wise thing to do.
Doug?
And also, you know, you're talking about places around the world where there is not an in-place infrastructure to build roads. There isn't the industry, the private business that we have here that can build roads much better than the military can. And also when we look at
– In rural Alabama?
Well, because
you can very
easily bring private resources to any part of this country much better than you could, much more efficiently than you would deploy military units to do that. And you know where we engage in that sort of infrastructure development, whether or not it is a justifiable objective, we're doing it where there aren't a plethora of engineering and construction companies and people who are trained in the modern techniques. And I think that's a little bit different. But to your original point about, you know, we've always had a National Guard that are part-time trained individuals with specific training on emergency response that can be stood up at times of emergency. This is the first major hurricane that has hit the New York area in many years. It doesn't happen on a regular basis. So trying to best use our resources is, I think, ultimately what even somebody, to a great degree, what Ron Paul is talking about. It is not, as the Democrats always cry about, it is not a matter of Republicans saying we shouldn't be doing these things, but we should be doing them differently and better.
Well, now, the last time, as I recall, if it wasn't the last time, maybe it was the time before that when you were on this program and we were talking about U.S. military might, I believe you were very critical of the U.S. policy or the president's policy as it relates to Libya. Given what happened in Libya last week, if it wasn't you, let me apologize.
Let me wear the jacket for whoever it was, which is fine.
You don't think it was you? Because I thought it was you.
No, it wasn't. I haven't been on since we started the Libya engagement.
So the issue is, Does the president get some credit for what happened in Libya last week with a policy that was roundly criticized? It's called, you know, leading from behind, without a significant number of American troops, without loss of life, and yet the end result is Gaddafi's power is gone. And, you know, they haven't found him yet, but, you know, his days are numbered.
Well, there's some very important points to remember here. We don't know who's going to replace Gaddafi.
We never do. So
the final chapter on this is not written. Now, the bottom line is that I think that we have too many people on all sides of the spectrum who want to apply blanket policies to foreign engagements. They're all different. The reason that I think one of the main reasons that this engagement has thus far proven to be more successful than virtually anything else in the foreign policy realm that the Obama administration has touched is that in the Libya situation, you have European countries with a very significant vested interest and connections to that country. They were much more proactive. They felt much more the need to be engaged, thus providing us with the ability to, quote, lead from behind, where we were providing the hardware and the military expertise, but we were allowing European powers that are much more engaged and versed in Libyan politics to really take the policy lead.
But
that doesn't exist in every situation.
But the hawks in the Senate, John, the hawks in the Senate, you know, the John McCains, the Lindsey Grahams, they were all criticizing this policy. They were saying the United States wasn't flexing its muscle, it wasn't using its military strength, and had we done that, first of all, there would have likely been loss of lives. In this particular case, Gaddafi's gone and there wasn't a loss of U.S. lives.
And I, my reaction to that is that Gaddafi, as reprehensible as he was and is, as bizarre a dictator as he was, posed no threat to the United States. He had been defanged after George W. Bush invaded Iraq when he divested himself of his weapons of mass destruction. And I don't believe it's the function of the United States to be traveling the world looking for dictators to overthrow. If we do that, we're going to be very busy indeed, because there are many distasteful regimes around the world. The thing I think we tend to forget about this is the reason that NATO got involved is because when the Arab Spring spread to Libya and uprisings began there, the French in particular were afraid that if this turned out badly, that there would be a surge of refugees arriving on the Riviera. And they did not want that to happen. They wanted to get involved, topple Gaddafi quickly before they found themselves faced with a new refugee problem. The Italians felt the same way. Mm-hmm. And this was the genesis of the European interest in it, which enabled the United States then to provide the heavy lifting.
Dan?
The Obama administration does not look at the Arab world like the Republicans looked at the Arab world for years through sunglasses or rose-colored glasses. I mean, I think you got to give the president credit for being ahead of the game on this, identifying all these Arab nations, Jordan, Yemen, Libya, Syria. The young people are uprising because of economic distress, high unemployment. Obama jumped in at the right time to eliminate these dictators. And I think that his credit is that he does not see the Arab
to eliminate what dictators.
He does not see the Arab world as John sees it, which is they're no threat to the United States. So let's keep these dictators in power because that's good for.
Gaddafi was no threat to the United States. I heard someone say that the president should get credit for Egypt. What in God's name credit
or
attaches
Yemen.
To Egypt to
or
toppling,
well,
toppling a leader who was a faithful ally of the United States for more than three decades? How is their credit attached to whatever role the president played in toppling
Hosni
Mubarak?
And the president can't get credit even for Libya for leading from behind. We provided necessary support, but we provided no leadership. We provided the technical ability to provide air cover, but we did not lead. We did not devise this strategy. It was devised by NATO and primarily by the French and the Italians. So I know it's hard because there's so many opportunities to do it, but you have to be a little more measured in heaping praise on this president, but because this really is, you know, leading by behind, from behind in this instance made sense, and I will give him credit that strategically it was not the worst way to approach getting rid of Gaddafi, which I do think was valid. But, you know, let's also not make it greater than it is.
Why do you think it was valid? John didn't think it was valid. He didn't think he was an aging despot that wasn't bothering the United States. He was brutalizing his people.
Well, bear in mind, he also like Assad in Syria, had a very, very clear-cut succession process in place. We have Bashar Assad, who is simply the continuation of his despotic father. The same mechanism was in place in Libya, because even if Gaddafi had died, his sons would have taken over and quite possibly could have been even more brutal. So there is validity, and I think Gaddafi still was a great source of a great bad player on the scene.
John, I'll give you a chance to follow up on that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight, taking America's political pulse. And tonight, right at the moment, we're talking about foreign policy and Libya and the fall of Mr. Gaddafi. Back shortly. Bruce DeWitt back in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us this evening. Dan Shulman is here. He's making his first visit to Beyond the Beltway. He is a Democrat consultant and head of Dan Shulman Incorporated. But also, before we go too much further, let's talk a little bit about your background. It's very impressive. When did you meet Barack Obama? Because you hitched onto a star that went a long, long way, and you were an integral part of him being elected president of the United States. An independent author made that comment about you in a recently published book. So that must give you great comfort.
Well, I first met Barack Obama when he was running for state senator in 1995, and I started working for him in January of 1997 until about June of 2006. For about 9.5 years, either as a staff assistant in the General Assembly, Illinois Senate, and then as campaign manager and political director for three of his campaigns, for state senate and then U.S. Senate.
As a legislative staffer, and by the way, Doug O'Brien, who we're going to meet in just a moment, has a similar background coming out of the state legislative process. But as a state lawmaker, you're working with state lawmakers, and you're obviously a political animal. You're a junkie. You got it big time. When did you first realize that there was something special about this guy, and when did you think that maybe this guy could become president of the United States?
Well, if you read Obama's book, Audacity of Hope, he talks about the first thing I told him was, have you been to Southern Illinois? And he said, I've never been to Southern Illinois. Why do I need to go? My district is in the south side of Chicago. And I said, well, Senator, I said, if you're going to learn how to vote for all of Illinois, which you do as a legislator, I'm going to take you down to Southern Illinois. So we packed up our golf clubs. We went down to Southern Illinois for a week and met a bunch of folks, as he indicated. And it was in that trip that I realized that he had a magical ability to connect with people that really had no similarity to him in any way, shape, or form. And he had never been, you know, anywhere in the South. And not that the Southern Illinois is the South, but it was really an eye-opening
experience. It's further south than Richmond, Virginia, though.
And on the way back, he said, you know what, I can get these folks can vote for me. And I think it was it was an awakening in my eyes that he had appeal. He had mass appeal and broad appeal.
All right, now let me take another run at that same question. Take us inside how you personally feel. I mean, you're a guy that saw very, very early. If you weren't the first to see, you were one of the very first to see, and maybe you instilled in this young green state senator a thirst to know a little bit more. And that thirst led to one of the most significant political upsets in the history of this country. How does it make you personally feel? I mean, do you think about it?
I'm still amazed when I think about what happened. And there were certain moments that were almost unbelievable. I call him the Mick Jagger or the Tiger Woods of American politics. I mean, at moments he had a cataclysmic rise. The speech at the convention in 2004, when he won the Democratic primary in 2004. Certain things that happened have caused him to have, and as some people say, he's the luckiest man alive. But it's hard to believe that 10 years ago he could walk down the street right in front of where we are today and nobody would recognize him. He was essentially a backbencher state senator, unrecognized, and I think that it's really a credit to America that we have a person of a multiracial individual who has been this successful, and he really is a brilliant person, and it's his intellect that has gotten him where he is.
Doug O'Brien also joins us. He's our card-carrying Republican. He's a principal in Prairie State Strategies. He, too, has an illustrious career, not only working in the legislative branch, but also he was the regional director of Health and Human Services under Secretary Leavitt. And also he was a chief of staff for Congressman Mark Kirk, who is now a United States senator. And you've had a similar experience because you met Mark Kirk at a very young point in his career, and you saw that that move forward.
When I first met Mark, he was involved in the 2000 primary for an open seat. There were 11 candidates running for the North Shore 10th Congressional District, and Mark really very quickly made an impression on people in politics. Here was somebody who really had no background. He had been a staffer in D.C. He'd practiced law. He'd worked at the World Bank, but had a stellar resume, but no political experience, no political infrastructure. But you could quickly see that this was somebody who was going to be able to make a very, very strong connection with voters as well. Also somebody with impeccable academic credentials, but also somebody who really had an incredible skill set when it came to dealing with the very heady substance of today's policy. It is truly overwhelming in a sense, the degree, the depth and breadth of the issues that members of Congress have to deal with. And one of the great things about Mark was that he was such a quick study, not in a surface way, but in a real in-depth way, on virtually every policy issue that he's always come across.
John Kuchelko also joins us. He is served as the town assessor of Cicero for more than 11 years. He was an Illinois state representative. He is also was a town trustee, member of the Board of Education, planning commissioner. Talk about your overall local guy who became involved in politics. You got it in your bloodstream. You're also a member of the Chicago Civil War Roundtable. And you have a very unique perspective in that you do performance as Alexander Hamilton, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, FDR, Charles Dickens, and Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
Now, of all those, what is it about Hamilton? I'm going to ask you about the one that no one ever asks you about.
Hamilton.
What is unique about Alexander Hamilton, and exactly what is it that you do when you perform as Alexander Hamilton?
I like to call Alexander Hamilton the greatest president we never had, because he is a man who I think would have been a superb president of the United States. He's one of the unsung founding fathers of this nation. He put us on the road to become the nation that we are today. He would recognize America as the greatest power in the world. He would recognize his hometown, New York City, as the center of finance. He would recognize what America became in the 20th century, even though Americans perhaps were not quite ready for that in his time, and inclined more toward the Jeffersonian pastoral image of America of the yeoman farmers. But I think he is just a tremendous figure, and I try to portray this vision that he had for America. He foresaw the America that is today. He saw America as a financial, industrial, military power. At a time when we were brand new, we were this cluster of former colonies on the eastern seaboard.
The first treasure of the United States. That's
right. And he foresaw that. You know, the Prime Minister of Great Britain is also the first Lord of the Treasury, and he thought of himself as essentially Washington's Prime Minister. He, to some extent, saw Washington as the monarch and himself as the prime minister of the new government. Now, that format did not take, but that's how he envisioned it.
So when you do a presentation, I mean, do you, especially with someone like FDR or Theodore Roosevelt,
right.
Certainly FDR, people would understand what he sounded like.
Sure.
Do you try to mimic them, or is it a theatrical presentation, or is it more of a historical lecture on their career?
It's all. I try to present them as individuals, as if they have seen America continue.
It's a little bit of Hamilton.
Hamilton, of course, has.
What did he sound like?
He would be a New York. He would have an early New York.
Yeah, there were no recordings. Pulling your leg here.
Yeah, you have to just kind of make his. Teddy Roosevelt's a little easier because we know that he talked a little bit like this, and Teddy Roosevelt had a very quick, forceful way of speaking. There are recordings of Theodore Roosevelt, and he spoke a bit like this. And of course, with FDR, you have my friends, neighbors, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. Try to do the voice.
And very good. Yeah. How long does your presentation last?
35, 40, 45 minutes. I try to present their life story, their vision of America today, so it's not purely historical, but the role they played in building the America that we know today.
So someday in the future, and we would give you advance warning, if you ever came back to be a guest on the show, you could be in character. And I could be doing an interview with Abraham Lincoln.
I would be willing to do
talking
that.
Talking about historic figures.
Certainly.
You'd have to get a little taller.
A little bit taller.
I wear.
Or FDR. That was a great thing. We were talking about where the military power of the United States is going to be. And you were making a point about that Obama is not going to get the credit. Perhaps some believe he deserves for this vision that he has demonstrated in Libya. Well, and I'm from a political standpoint, it seems to me that with getting bin Laden and now getting the new number two guy in Al-Qaeda just this past week, on top of what's happening in Libya, it seems to me that in running for re-election, there may be at least one element of the traditional Republican arsenal which is leveled against a Democrat. And I'm going to ask you this question, Doug. I mean, he has some credibility in issues that a lot of Democrats don't have credibility. I want you to think about that answer, and I'm going to let everybody respond to that as well when we come back. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. We've got a great guest tonight. Nice to have you with us. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast that sort of the big news politically is that a new poll has come out. It's a Gallup poll, well recognized. And again, we should mention that this is a poll of name recognition. It's a poll collectively of the entire United States. It's not state by state, which is how you obviously build up delegate counts. But again, there was a rather significant transformation in that poll, and it found that Rick Perry is now in the lead with 29%. Prior to that, Mitt Romney was in the lead. Romney has now shifted to the second place at 17%. Ron Paul at 13% in the top three, ahead of Michelle Bachmann, who is on the heels of the Iowa straw poll win. She's at 10%. And then Herman Cain at 4%, along with the former speaker, 4%. That must really drive Newt Gingrich up the wall to think that he's, even with the former pizza maker. Rick Santorum is at 3%, and John Huntsman is at 1%. And one of the things that Huntsman in the last week, he sort of stole some thunder by really sort of leveling, some people in the Republican Party. And making a very strong case for, I guess, what would be described as a moderate to liberal wing or suburban element of the party. And two things I wanted to get your reaction, Doug. First of all, the surge of Rick Perry. Does that, in your view, mean he is real?
Oh, he's certainly real. He's the governor of the second largest state in the country. He's been a governor for a decade. He he speaks uniquely in this cycle to where I think a pretty significant proportion of the electorate are at. Frustration with Washington in general, frustration with the status quo. But I think that obviously there's a lot more football to be played here. And you're still talking about, quote, a front runner who does not garner a third of the support. Mm-hmm. This is still very, very early. You get into sample sizes that big, and there's a lot of variance.
My other question to you, and then I want to get the other guest's response. What is Huntsman's strategy then? I mean, basically by sort of leveling some of the, at least the ideologues in the party. At least in the last debate coming out for, you know, civil unions. Obviously, he is left of center of many other candidates in the race. I mean, how does he carve a win out of this field? And do you think that's a strategy that could propel him further down the road, if not to the nomination?
Well, it is the $64,000 question, because obviously there's a great deal of concern about whether or not a very doctrinaire conservative can have the crossover appeal, particularly to those independents who are desperately seeking an alternative to the current administration. Huntsman has sought to stake out that center-right ground in the Republican Party. So far, he has not been able to get traction on a national basis, but I think where you want to look is you want to see if he starts getting traction in early states, particularly in New Hampshire, that has a very independent and moderate streak to it.
Anybody on this list, Dan, that worries you as a Democrat?
Well, I think the Republicans should have kept Tim Pawlenty in the race because he's actually a reasonable candidate. I think that Perry is a flavor of the month. 4 years ago, Giuliani was leading at this time. He faded. Many times this is it's too early to tell. But once people shine a light on his record, on his positions on Social Security, states' rights, how he raised the number of jobs in the public sector, his positions on immigration – I was talking to a Republican state senator last week, and he had agreed to introduce him around, but he had indicated that he, too, was fearful of the vetting process as people really look into I was a victim of the vetting process 4 years ago with Obama and how they tore him inside and out. Well, let's tear Perry inside and out, and let's see if his positions are mainstream or out of the mainstream.
Okay. John?
Well, I think that Rick Perry's greatest claim is the fact that he is the longest-serving governor of the second biggest state in the Union. The three greatest presidents of the 20th century, in my estimation, Roosevelt, Reagan, and Roosevelt, were all in their time governor of the largest state in the nation, New York for the Roosevelts and California for Reagan. That is excellent preparation to be president of the United States. Far better than being a short-time state legislator and briefly a United States senator. Governors have to manage things. They have to run things and make decisions, which is what a chief executive does. And I think Perry has done an outstanding job in Texas, particularly job creation.
Do you think, by the way, but on the issue of job creation, this was one of the areas you mentioned. We've all heard that Texas has raised more or created more jobs than any other state in the union, but what about that many of those jobs might have been created because of the stimulus money that went to Texas, and many of those jobs are low-level jobs?
Well, Bruce, since Time magazine reported this week, and I have a copy right here, that despite the go-it-alone image that Perry cultivates, private sector jobs have fallen by 0.7% since December of 2007 when the recession hit, while public sector jobs have grown 3.7%. So I think you have an indication of a hypocrite here. Clearly someone that the Texas miracle is not from Rick Perry.
Well, and as long as Democrats are quibbling about this, that is going to help Rick Perry and it's going to help Republicans, because the bottom line, it contrasts to the abysmal job creation record of this current administration. They'll nitpick on it all they want and try to split hairs on it, but it proves the point that this administration has been asleep at the switch on jobs.
On that note, that was Doug O'Brien. He is our card-carrying Republican. Dan Schulman is with us. He's our card-carrying Democrat. And John Kuchelko also joins us. He is our card-carrying historian, impersonator. I mean, when was the last time you heard of... Well, you have a few others.
Yes, I do. I enjoy.
What are you going to do in the next hour?
If you want, give us
a little bit of Ronald Reagan in the next hour, okay? 1-800-723-8289 if you're listening to us on radio. We'll be back for another hour. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. So long, everybody. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican consultant Doug O'Brien, Democrat consultant Dan Shulman, and political historian John Colicchio. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. btb@museum.tv. And it's Kachulko. I think I screwed up your name, John, at the beginning, but forgive me for that. We've been talking about politics. We've been talking about the change in the Republican field with Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, moving to the front of the list, at least escorting the polls surveyed by the Gallup organization. And we were talking about whether or not Rick Perry's touting his record as creating jobs was going to be maybe a short-lived positive. And, Dan, you were making the point that it's not all that it's cracked up to be.
1 million people still unemployed in Texas. Half a million people have low-wage, minimum-wage jobs of people with jobs in Texas. The data indicates that a lot of the jobs he created were public sector jobs due to the oil and gas explosion. So there's a lot of issues there. But most importantly, I think when people see some of his positions on issues like the Federal Reserve, Social Security, they might become concerned, especially as like-minded Midwesterners of open-minded thoughts, we might see that he is out of the mainstream of the rest of the country.
Doug O'Brien, our Republican guest tonight.
Well, I'm gratified to hear that the Democrats are obviously going to seek to change the subject at whatever cost possible to make this the quote out of the mainstream argument again. And if we're going to start playing this game of splitting hairs and parsing words, it really is unfortunate that Rick Perry couldn't create more jobs in Texas because he was operating under the onus of the Obama economic policies, which tied one hand behind his back and prevented him from creating even more jobs in Texas in a less regulated climate. But a great contrast is here in Illinois, where we have pretty universal Democrat policies that have just proven to be absolutely disastrous for the job market.
John Kachulko, your comment on this.
I believe that upwards of 40% of the jobs that have been created during the Obama time in the White House have been created in Texas. When I hear this criticism that they are low-paying jobs, it suggests that it's better to be unemployed at a high wage than to be employed at a lesser wage. I think people in this economy are grateful to have jobs and the fact that they're being created in Texas. And when they talk about the fact that there's defense spending in Texas, well, Texas is by no means the only state in which there's defense spending. Why have they been so successful there? I think it's because of the policies that the governor's enacted.
We've got callers on the line. Let's go to Scott listening to us on WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, gentlemen, how you doing this evening?
Okay, and yourself?
Oh, not too bad. Thanks for taking my call. This is directed toward Dan. Well, first of all, let me make a comment on what you gentlemen were just discussing, Rick Perry. I don't like him. He's just another big government guy, and he he's a Bilderberg guy, and the heck with him. But anyway, I'm calling about Obama, and I'm a fan of Obama, and he's taken a beating here in the last few weeks, last few months. And what I'm hearing a lot of people say, at least people that I know, is they're starting to question his intellectual abilities and his abilities to grasp the concepts and the different challenges that he faces. And I don't know what to say because, you know, obviously we know he's a smart guy, but how do we defend him? I mean, there's really nothing tangible to show people. I mean, he won't release his records. So what do we say? What do we do?
Dan.
I mean, knowing President Obama as I do for 16 years, he is a civil rights scholar, a law professor, rose to the position of the editor of the Harvard Law Review. He is a well-read man. He reads the New York Times cover to cover every day. An amazing
that could be the main problem right there. There's the problem. We've isolated the problem.
Carry some states.
I think that was what shocked me during the campaign when people said, oh, he's just a good speaker. He's not very smart. Well, you're not a good speaker unless you are very smart.
But wait a minute, Dan. Let me ask this question in a maybe a little more pointed way. The rhetorical skills that he had that propelled him through the nomination process and made him president of the United States, a lot of people who are huge fans of his but are disappointed with him is that his communication skills are – he has not used his communication skills as president like he did as a candidate. And so it took him a while to figure out what message he wanted to talk about health care. What did he want to talk about the stimulus? You know, even in the in laying the case out for Libya, it wasn't the Barack Obama of 4 years ago. It was almost like the great communicator had lost a step or two.
Well,
you think there's any truth to that?
I think it's fair to say that he did not communicate well on some issues, such as health care. I think it's fair to say that was muddled, and I believe it was muddled. I think most Americans don't even know what's in the health care package. If they did, they would support it at a greater percentage.
Does the president know what's in it?
Oh, I think he knows what's – I know he knows what's in it. And I think on the economic stimulus package, I think they misfired a little bit on some of the issues. But ultimately, I was reading Time magazine just today. In the states that were the key voting states, like Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, unemployment is going down. And so I think there is a turnaround now, and I think that we're on the upswing.
Well, it's going to go down fast enough.
I sure hope.
Hey, Dan?
Go ahead.
Dan?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. You're on my side. But the people I know, again, they hammer me. And they always say, well, if this guy's so smart, why won't he release his transcripts? What do I say to him?
What transcripts on what?
I don't know how to respond to that.
What transcripts are you talking about?
Well, it's college, Harvard, Columbia. We haven't seen any of that stuff.
Scott, let me be blunt here. Does anybody, I mean, really, I mean, he's president of the United States. He's been president of the United States for 3 years now. Why is that important? He's done so much as president that you can either like or dislike. What are you worried about his college transcripts for? It's like worrying about whether or not he's a citizen or not. He's a citizen. You're not going to unchange the last 3 years. Don't waste your time on it.
I'm getting hammered on this. I'm a fan
of
this guy.
Tell your friends to wake up. Tell your friends to wake up. There's all kinds of things you can criticize them on, but that's not it.
First, it was I heard today that one of the Republican talk shows was saying now, who was his cocaine dealer? I mean, anything to distract away from what really matters, which is that he cares about the American people.
That's completely ridiculous. You know, nobody questions the president's academic credentials in a serious way. But even a very, very smart man can make bad policy decisions.
We've got a pause. 1-800-723-8029. More calls when we come back from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. John, you had a comment. You were going to...
We were talking about how smart the president is, and I understand he's a friend of yours, and I respect that. But, you know, we've been told from the time he got into politics by his supporters and his friends in the media how smart Barack Obama is. We've heard that on and on and on. My question is not to his intelligence or how many times he reads the New York Times, but the fact that I don't believe he had the experience. I don't believe that he has the leadership qualities to be an effective chief executive of the United States. He was a legislator. And in general, legislators don't make effective presidents. As far as his smartness, we never had a public official in this nation who could rival John Quincy Adams for intelligence. He was a brilliant man. He was an abysmal failure as president of the United States. He was one of the worst presidents we ever had.
Let's go to Gene listening to us in Oak Park. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Anyway, I'm drawing your show, Bruce.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I like all the Republican candidates. I think Perry is kind of like a loose cannon, though, especially when I heard that he mandated this medication for 16-year-old girls to prevent cervical cancer, another mandate, such like Obama is prone to do. Now, I still think, and my favorite has been Mitt Romney. He seems to be cool and collected, you know, like he's always one, two, or three. You know, it's like the shell game. He's either there, middle, or, you know, one, two, three, or three, two, one. But, I mean, I do appreciate the way he handles himself. And those agitators were sent out, you know, in the audience, too. They're professional agitators sent out by the liberals to agitate the man. Mm-hmm. So I do like the way he's presenting himself. As far as Perry goes, which I said, I think he's a little bit of a hothead. You know, he shoots from the hip and all of that. He's interesting. I like all the Republican candidates. Anyway, any one of them except Obama.
Okay, we got you loud and clear on that. One of the things that that we've been talking about also is, and you made the point, you know, what happened with Barack Obama, the vetting process that goes through when you run for president of the United States. Mitt Romney has at least been through the process once. That's one of the reasons why maybe a lot of Republican primary voters tend to nominate someone that ran once before. It's sort of at least sort of the rules of the game for the last at least probably four or five presidential cycles. But in the case of Rick Perry, he came out of nowhere. But again, there have been some questions, and I'm wondering, what are the vetting things that are out there? Because there have been some rumors that have been out there that Rick Perry was not going to run because of some things that he's concerned about. I don't want to ask how likely is it that these things come out, but why is it taking so long for these things to come out if indeed there are such things? And by the way, let me just open anyone listening on KLBJ in Austin, Texas. If you are aware of that, let me know what you know, because again, this is part of the rumor whispers in the bar. I mean, there's whispers that are out there.
Well, let me jump in briefly just to give the callers an idea of the vetting process in a presidential campaign. I was involved in that with Obama. It is thorough. I mean, I think that what Perry's people are doing now is overturning every stone, pulling out every document they have, and this is an unbelievable process that they're going through themselves to protect their own candidate. And then at the same time, you can assume that the other candidates and potentially the Obama campaign are looking through everything that they can find about his records. I saw today something about how his travel records were not going to be released by the state of Texas. I don't know whether that's legitimate or not, but it's an exhaustive process that's very thorough. I think John had something to say.
Well, he's been through several tough races in Texas. It's an open secret that the Bush family is not friendly to Rick Perry. He went through a bruising primary fight with Kay Bailey Hutchinson, an incumbent Republican senator who tried to take the gubernatorial nomination away from him. It seems to me if there were anything toxic in Rick Perry's background, it would have come out in Texas. Texas politics ain't beanbag, as was said once.
Doug?
I think one of the unfortunate issues here too is that right now is a part of the process, and I'm sure Dan, you can appreciate this, is a time when you sit down with a lot of prospective candidates and you have to have that very, very frank conversation. Mm-hmm. And you have to say to people who are good people, who want to serve, who want to be involved in public life, and you have to really, in a sense, you have to seek to humiliate them. You have to seek to crawl into the deepest recesses of their life and find the most embarrassing things that have happened to them or the things that they have done. And you have to make them aware of how people will use that to try to personally destroy them. This will happen and has happened to every candidate. Of course, it happened to Barack Obama. And of course, Barack Obama is going to do the same thing to anybody who runs against him. You know, this is, you know, we all have our righteous indignation about it.
You've been involved in campaigns with candidates that have had at least those speculative rumors that have had to be dealt with.
Oh, absolutely. And no, in this day and age, no candidate is immune to some sort of, and one of the problems is that if you don't have something in your record, either on Twitter or on blogs, people will make things up. And there is no accountability for those things. And now rumor is a much more potent weapon to use. It's not just whispers at the water cooler, but it's potentially a rumor that can anonymously put out to thousands and thousands of people.
So you do you, again, you've both been in sort of on the insides of planning these campaigns. And, John, you've been involved in campaigns as well. But, I mean, when you have that heart-to-heart with a candidate, and I'm sure that you gentlemen did, I mean, at some point you have to measure, okay, the candidate has come clean about something. We now have to measure where that falls on the political Richter scale, mm-hmm. and whether or not they can get away with it, right?
Oh, I've said to prospective candidates with whom I've met after one meeting, I would advise you not to run for office.
Yeah,
I've had that conversation.
I mean, the Jeremiah Wright potential, didn't you know about that before the world knew about it?
On that issue, what I say is 90% of Americans probably have never been to a black church. So they don't understand and the interpretation, the interpretive nature of the African-American church. I think the Jeremiah Wright thing from the beginning was really an analysis of people that didn't understand the black culture of religion. And I always felt like from the beginning that was he was unfairly cast. That church, which is here in Chicago, is a very mainstream, has a bunch of mainstream members, doctors, lawyers, engineers, physicians.
But Dan, were you aware, before it broke, because you knew in your heart, because you've been through a lot of campaigns, with him, did you know that thing was going to explode at some point, given the nature of the vetting and the pressure and what he was fighting for?
I didn't know that the media and Americans would misinterpret Reverend Wright's words and then characterize him as a radical based on the fact that they didn't understand the interpretive nature of the African-American church.
So does that mean
the words aside, goddamn America aside, it's really hard to conceive of how Americans in the suburbs could take offense. There's a certain point at which you have to take ownership of your actions and your affiliations, and to have the ability to own up to it rather than trying to explain away. You have somebody in a church, a spiritual leader, saying things that obviously could create offense for many, many Americans. And rather than owning up for that, it is something that we can explain away through sociology and lack of it. You who are offended are the ones who are wrong. You are wrong to be offended rather than owning up for these words.
The key thing about that and the timing of that, in my view, was that is something that had that happened in the general election, Republicans would have been viewed as racist for bringing it up.
Well, guess
but
what?
The person that had to fight that battle was Hillary Clinton.
2 miles from...
And she didn't come across that great in that story.
2 miles or 1 mile from Reverend Wright Church, four-year-olds are being shot on their front porch because they live in poor African-American neighborhoods.
Which has nothing to do with whether or not words can offend. Words can, and Democrats are the... champions of screaming bloody murder anytime a word causes offense. And rather than and demanding that everyone must appreciate sensitivity at all levels, but when a Democrat says something that creates offense to people, to others, it is always the fault of those who are offended because they are not smart enough to be as sophisticated to understand things like the dynamics of the African-American church, rather than saying these words are offensive to many people and they should not be uttered, it is always others' faults.
If George W. Bush had sat in a church and listened to a clergyman say anything that could be construed as being offensive to any constituency in the Democratic Party, you can bet that Democrats and the media would have come down on Bush like the proverbial ton of bricks. He would have been forced to answer for that over and over and over and over.
Yeah, but it's
so
okay.
To bring it to what we're talking about right now, and then we're gonna have to pause because we got a call coming in. To bring it to right now, and I want you to think about it. I'll ask the question now. But to think about it, to put it in context, is in this campaign, everybody expects, I'm asking this everybody rhetorically right now, everyone expects that this could be a very nasty campaign for president.
Absolutely.
And sure. A nasty campaign for the nomination.
Sure.
Do
Absolutely.
Our Republicans agree with that?
Absolutely.
All right, 1-800-723-8029. We'll talk about that nastiness when we come back. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Our Democrat tonight is Dan Shulman. He is the head of his own consulting firm, and he works in public affairs and political campaigns and has known the President of the United States long before it was fashionable, long before anybody knew who he was. He was on that train very, very early.
He's
encouraging him to go upward and onward.
Well, I didn't tell him to run for president, but
did he ask you if he should?
No, he asked me on every race up until then, and so did Michelle. And I went through the process with her of every race when he ran for Congress and U.S. Senate, what this was going to entail, whether he could win, what my assessment were. So, but not the presidency.
And when did you last see him?
I saw him 3 weeks ago. I was at the White House for his birthday party.
Oh, very good. Well, tell him the next time you see him, tell him it's been a long time since he's been on Beyond the Beltway. But he used to do the show periodically.
Well, Bruce, I know he's a big fan of yours when you used to interview him when he was in the Illinois legislature for Illinois lawmakers, and I know he admires you greatly.
Well, great. Now, that's great. Hey, let me pat myself on the back. Now, how do we get him on some future show? Because they're going to be running the campaign about a mile from here. So see what you can do. Put in a good word with your friends in high places. It's nice to know. It's nice to know. And it's nice to know the President of the United States. I said this during the campaign. I mean, I covered Barack Obama for about 15 years. And so, there's something interesting, President of the United States were to walk in, he'd call you by your first name. Sure. There's a little bit of something neat about that.
Any president who came out of Illinois would know your name.
Well, absolutely. But there hasn't been that many that have come out of Illinois.
Lincoln spoke very highly
yeah,
of
Lincoln.
You.
And Grant. Hey, how are you, Mr. Grant, President? Don't Grant, go to the theater, please.
Grant theater. Often spoke well of you.
We used to drink together. Right? Doug O'Brien also joins us. He is the head of his group, which is called Prairie State Strategies. He also headed the HHS in Illinois. During in 2005, and also worked chief of staff for Congressman Mark Kirk, and was also involved in the state legislature. And again, two great pedigrees from both sides of the political aisle joining us this evening, as well as John Kotulko, who joins us. And he is a former town assessor of Cicero, has held virtually all the major positions in that village just to the west of Chicago. And again, he's a member of the Civil War Roundtable, and he did a great job. And one of the things he does is he does public presentations on such luminous figures as Alexander Hamilton, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, FDR, Charles Dickens, and Sherlock Holmes. And before we left the last hour, Dan asked if you do an impression. He was surprised that Ronald Reagan was not on this list. Do you do Ronald Reagan?
I just love it. Well, Nancy and I are so proud and glad to be here, and I paid for this microphone, by the way. But no, I haven't yet added him to my repertoire of presidents.
Let us go to Jeff, listening to us in Waco, Texas, on KLBJ. He's not calling in to talk about the governor of Texas. He's calling in to talk about another governor. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I'm a Republican, have been pretty much since Ronald Reagan, my first election. And, you know, I look what's going on out here, and all of a sudden Rick Perry, who's our governor, gets in the race, and now he's a front runner. We have no focus and no leadership in terms of we flip-flop like we're teenage girls, decide who's our best friend. The only person that captivated me, and I'll tell you, Obama cannot be underestimated. He's a captivating speaker, and I believe he sincerely believes what he believes. I just don't believe the things he believes in are right. But the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, when I heard him speak when he was the labor union issues were going on there, he captivated me. A different style, but yet captivating. And unless we get a guy like that in the race that speaks from the heart, and we just can't beat Obama. I don't care how bad the economy is. Not going
to
happen.
Jeff, in your view, stay on the line. I want to get everybody's reaction to this, and then we'll come back to you for the last word. John Kotulko, who out there would be trying to get Chris Christie into this race? With a list that's out there, and I guess there was also a poll this week that said that now it appears for the first time that maybe Republican voters are sort of satisfied with their field, meaning obviously Rick Perry got into right. The race. But who would be out there trying to get somebody else, whether it's Chris Christie or Sarah Palin or anyone else?
Well, I think the media, they want to stir the pot. They want a story. They'd love to have a new name every week if they could. They'd probably like to get Jeb Bush into the race. I think Jeb Bush would have made a great president and may at some point in the future may still make a great president. But I think the media has this interest. I think we've got a pretty wide field as it is. And I think Perry answers the questions that a lot of conservatives had. They were looking for a full-spectrum conservative, national defense, social issues, economy, budget, deficit. He answers all. He checks all
so
of those.
So with Perry in, again, it's not likely. But my question to you, Doug, who would be, and again, we should mention you've had some flirtations with John Huntsman, but who would, what would be the money sources that would be pushing Christie to get into this race when at least the top three seem to be locked in?
Well, the major donors, the major political operatives, the political players are all. It remains a pretty fluid situation. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who have agreed to help out certain candidates, but there's still a lot of Republican support that is not spoken for, and a lot of people who aren't necessarily whose allegiance is not necessarily carved in stone. And with respect to Governor Christie, Governor Christie is a compelling individual. I've had the good fortune to spend some time with him, and he's remarkable, I think, for his frankness, his command of issues, and his vision, his clarity of vision, which I think is the thing that people are most impressed by because he cuts to the chase. But one of the things that is a problem is that Chris Christie is definitely in that more moderate wing of the Republican Party. And I think that there are a lot of people who say, oh, we'd love to see Chris Christie in this race, but then there are a lot of conservatives, social conservatives, who had set about eviscerating him the moment he got into the race, and that's one of the problems we're facing in getting a good field, because I think that's one of the issues that kept Mitch Daniels out of the race, who I dare say at this point would be a clear front runner in the race for this nomination had he chosen to run.
All right, Dan, Chris Christie, is America ready for a big, heavy-set, tough-talking politician?
I think he's got a shot because I think, you know, look at Rick Perry. Another thing that he said is Social Security. He wrote this book where he said that Social Security was a Ponzi scheme, something he repeated again recently. I think that he's going to disintegrate based on his out-of-the-mainstream values. I think they're going to be looking for people like Christie. I mean, look, the mayor of New York who stood up this week did a tremendous job, Bloomberg. I think that the Republicans will be fleeing from Perry in the next couple of months. And Chris Christie's definitely a possibility. I mean, he's got an anti-teacher record, you know, but he generally is probably a little more moderate and I think maybe more electable in the general.
Now, let's talk about cosmetics now. For those people who are listening on radio, you're a big, robust, hefty guy. He's probably got a few, maybe he's got about 40 pounds on you, but I mean, he's
a little more than that. I hope.
Maybe 80 pounds. he may have those on me as well.
I'm dieting.
My question to you is in this world of telegenics, can someone who looks like him be taken seriously in a Republican primary? Brutally frank, I want to get you because this is a personal issue as well.
You know, I think that I don't think it's an issue. I think that I think his health would be an issue if he had some serious health issue down the line. I mean, this was an issue with Obama when they talked about the smoking,
right?
You know that was going to be a problem. As somebody is a health nut and somebody that really doesn't drinks a negligible amount of alcohol, I think that, you know, the issue was his health, not that he had a bad habit. So I think Chris Christie would be fine on the health issue as long as he doesn't have some serious underlying condition.
John, what about you?
I think he comes across as a real guy, as a likable guy, a personable guy. I think that he would make an excellent candidate, and I don't think that would in any way be damaging to Chris Christie. But he's relatively new to the national.
And his
picture.
Voice on the hurricane. He said, "Get the hell off the beach."
And I think that's people like that. That's leadership. That is leadership.
Well, they may not like that he used the word "a."
Well, what is so compelling about him to the voters in play, the independents, the moderates who really are still seeking out somebody to follow in this race, what makes him so attractive to them will also be problematic in a Republican primary because Chris Christie is not doctrinaire. He is about telling it like it is and calling things the way he sees them. When he disagrees with the religious right, he will say so. That does not endear you to the religious right who really, really appreciate doctrinaire allegiance to each and every one of their issues.
So culturally, not politically, culturally, he could pick up some Democratic blue-collar Reagan Democrat voters.
Not some. I think he could overwhelm. He could swamp a big segment of the Democratic Party.
So he'd put Pennsylvania in play as
absolutely.
Well as New Jersey.
Absolutely.
And to those that say that one of the reasons why he would run for president is because he can't get reelected in New Jersey, you would say what?
Doesn't matter. He's beyond that. He is a national figure now.
But he would have difficulty getting reelected in New Jersey, would he not?
Sure, but I still don't think that would be a deal breaker given his unique persona.
Quick answer. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. That was the shortest answer in the history of the show. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. One more segment. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking about, at least according to the Gallup poll, the big three, Perry, Romney, and Ron Paul, slightly ahead of Michelle Bachmann. Ron Paul is certainly not likely to go away. He was on the TV, on one of the TV shows today, did a very nice job. By the way, our producer, Dan Dorfman, he did call the Ron Paul campaign. And we have asked Ron Paul, the media people have not returned our phone call yet.
However, the invitation is open for Ron Paul. Remember, last week we had someone calling up and say that Ron Paul's not getting his fair share of coverage. Well, he's got a great coverage in Time Magazine. He was on with Fox News Sunday today. And again, the invitation is open today for Ron Paul to be on this program. But as media people, they've got to return their calls. I mean, that's they should do that. By the way, in looking at this race with Rick Perry, Romney, and Ron Paul, I come back to 1980, and here's my analysis. Rick Perry is the Ronald Reagan figure. Mitt Romney is the George Bush figure, and Ron Paul is the John Anderson figure.
It's reasonable.
What do you think of that?
I think it's reasonable, and I think it's conceivable you could have the same result with a Perry-Romney ticket. I mean, I think that is certainly within the realm of possibility.
Are you trying to say that Ron Paul could run as an independent like John Anderson did from Rockford, Illinois, I will note.
Possibly.
I think that would be like almost like a Perot situation.
Right. I don't see
I believe
necessarily
he said he's not going to do that.
I see it more of a battle between the East or the moderate conservative wing or some business wing business elements in there. And then you had Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was not the favorite of the business community in 1980.
No.
So that's where I think the real similarity is. And again, as I've said a number of times the last couple of weeks, the stylistic way in which Rick Perry talks, the broad shoulders, the hair, everything else. I mean, to me, he's very Reagan-esque.
Wasn't Rick Perry a Democrat back then?
Yes, he was.
Ronald Reagan was once a Democrat.
You don't mind that he was a Democrat one more time?
No. I just think maybe he's got identity issues as to where he's at. I think he's not an ideologue by any means. He's an idealist. He's a monopolizing the Tea Party wave in terms of his positions. I wasn't around as much in 1980, but I'll say this, that I think that Ron Paul is not being divisive, and I don't see him as much as attacking the other candidates. But I think there's going to be a vicious attack coming your way in the next couple of months between the top candidates, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how they fall.
Brutality. We talked about this brutality in the Republican primary.
Well, you know, there's going to be
Bush Reagan was very brutal at certain points in that
absolutely,
campaign.
Absolutely. And this is in a lot of ways very similar, because there is a real opportunity here. The Republican nominee has a tremendous chance of unseating a Democrat incumbent, as occurred in 1980. So nobody is going to stand by and give up the opportunity to win this nomination and potentially the presidency. It's that important, and I think that Republicans see a tremendous opportunity. I think with all due respect to Ron Paul's small but very vocal core of followers, he is not a candidate who is likely to win the nomination, and he's certainly not a candidate who I see as being likely to win the presidency. He I think in a lot of ways has a very interesting impact on the debate in the same way that somebody who got the one thing I want to mention is that the same exact thing was being said about Jesse Jackson when he was running for president. Jesse Jackson was racking up delegates. He was racking up votes. And everybody knew that Jesse Jackson was not going to win the nomination. He was not going to get elected to the presidency. But he did have an impact on the debate within the Democratic Party. And I think Ron Paul, to a certain extent, is playing that role.
1988, Jesse Jackson, I think strategically, one of his worst mistakes was not pushing for, because he had the delegates. He should have pushed to be on that ticket with Michael Dukakis. Dukakis would have gone down, but then Jackson would have been the titular head of the party. For what Jackson wanted to do, he made a mistake. Frankly, he got bought off for whatever the reason.
Well, maybe that it might have helped the Democrats, since the Republicans, you know, the issue they used against Dukakis was a racially tinged issue. One of the big things, the Willie Horton ad. I think that some of that, you know, maybe if Jesse Jackson had been on the ticket, they could have better defended that position in that race.
But again, to me, when you're in a position like that, I mean, you could argue that Hillary Clinton could have done the same thing. But I saw it as a different I saw it in a different way. Jackson, you know, his whole career has been, you know, he wanted to be on the inside, fighting to get on the inside, fighting to change things. He would have had the bully pulpit of being the vice presidential candidate. Again, I'm not sure he would have won. But again, at that point, he would have been able to say, I was the vice presidential candidate, and I have to be taken seriously in 4 years from then, which would have been 1992.
Well, I went to Reverend Jackson's announcement for the presidency when he ran in 1980. It was in Washington, D.C. at the convention center. And he had charisma. He had amazing speaking abilities, but he didn't have an organization and a structure. And that's always been a criticism of Reverend Jackson. While he, you know, he's been a vocal voice, I don't think he could put together the mechanics and the machinery to get to that point.
Right. Let's go to John listening to us on KXLY in Culver, Washington. Go ahead.
Hello. I was just going to say that Rick Perry, I think, is doing his own vetting process. That's not going to take the internet to do it. His book clearly states that he thinks Social Security and Medicare are unconstitutional, and while that might not keep him from the Republican nomination, that's not going to win any hearts in the middle of the field, and the Republicans will nominate him at their peril, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good point, and it is it's in print, so it's kind of hard to back away from that. On that note, we're out of time for tonight's broadcast. Dan Schulman has been here. He has been our Democrat. Our Republican has been Doug O'Brien, and our political historian has been John Cotulco. John, nice to have you with us tonight, everybody.
Thank you for
good
the
group
opportunity.
Tonight. Thanks very much for being with us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio, and also our thanks Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman and Fritz Coleman for their assistance in the production of this program, along with Mark Flick. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.